All right, well, thank you all for getting here. We have a somewhat nondescript time to start. It's about 7 or 10:07:09. Sounds like a good time to me. So, looks like a quorum is present and we'll get underway. We are studying, as you know, the historical context of the New Testament now, although we're still working through a time period which would apply to the Old Testament, but really doesn't influence the Old Testament very much. But it's the era in which we have the rise of the Roman, first of all, kingdom that we looked at last week, the seven kings of Rome. And we were noting last week that each one of them makes a distinct contribution that becomes thematic for the development of the Roman culture. This morning, we're moving to the next kind of major chapter of Roman history, which is sometimes called the Roman Republic. And so we'll be focusing on that this morning. We're not quite still to the New Testament, but my promise to you is that by next week we will be. So thank you for your patience. I'm a little OCD as a Sunday school teacher. I need to start at the beginning and work my way through, you know. And so you're just kind of tolerating that, and I do appreciate it. But this morning we're going to be dealing with the Republican Roman world before it really becomes imperial. You know, Rome has kind of three great chapters: the kingdom, the republic, and the empire. And we are now in that second chapter, the republic, which goes from the year 509, when the Romans threw out their last king, Tarquin the Proud, because he had become such a scandalous character that the Romans not only got rid of him, but swore, never again are we going to have a king around here. And so even the later Caesars very scrupulously avoided ever calling themselves a king, because that was part of the culture, part of the tradition in Rome. But in 509, they got rid of that king and then established what was really a grand experiment. Really, for the first time in human history, we have a true experiment in republican government. Now, some would argue that that was true also in ancient Israel's jurisprudence and so on, and I would agree that at least to some degree we find some of those principles at work at a much earlier time, but it was always still with an understanding of a kind of theocratic ultimate governance in Israel, whereas in Rome, really, it became an independent republican type of approach. So that's what we want to look at today. And that does also shape the Roman psyche in a way that does show up, at least to some degree, when we look at the New Testament. And to illustrate that, I'd like to direct you to Luke chapter 7. And the text that we're going to read at the beginning and return to, as time permits, at the end is a famous incident in which Jesus has an interaction with a Roman centurion. And I think we see some things in this man which do reflect not only the work of grace in his heart, which is obviously there, but also something of the culture he had inherited from Rome's better days at an earlier time. Even though Rome had become imperial by now, there was still a very distinct memory of that Roman culture and the Roman Republic and so on. And you see little traces of it even here. So if you have your Bible and would like to follow along, it's in Luke chapter 7. And it's the first little story here of Jesus healing the centurion's servant. So Luke chapter 7, beginning at verse 1, this is the Word of God. After Jesus had finished all his sayings in the hearing of the people, he entered Capernaum. A centurion there had a slave whom he valued highly and who was ill and close to death. When he heard about Jesus, he sent some Jewish elders to him, asking him to come and heal his slave. When they came to Jesus, they appealed to him earnestly, saying, "He is worthy to have you do this for him, for he loves our people, and it is he who built our synagogue for us." And Jesus went with them. But when he was not far from the house, the centurion sent friends to him to say, "Lord, do not trouble yourself, for I am not worthy to have you come under my roof. Therefore, I did not presume to come to you, but only speak the word, and my servant will be healed. For I also am a man set under authority with soldiers under me. And I say to one, 'Go,' and he goes. and to another, come, and he comes. And to my slave, do this, and the slave does it. When Jesus heard this, he was amazed. And turning to the crowd that followed him, he said, I tell you, not even in Israel have I found such great faith. When those who had been sent returned to the house, they found the slave in good health. Remarkable and wonderful story. And we'll keep that in the back of our minds now, and we'll return to it a little later as we're wrapping up. Let's have a word of prayer, and we'll get started. Father, we are grateful to you for your many mercies to us, not the least of which is that we have this beautiful place in which to gather, that we have wonderful brothers and sisters in Christ with whom we can enjoy fellowship, that we have the scriptures that illumine our path, and that we have the opportunity through the presence and power of your Spirit to look into these texts. But we know that unless you open our eyes and illumine our hearts, we will do so blankly. And so we earnestly pray just now that you would be among us and that you would cause us to find in the review of the things that we're going to be looking at those truths that you would have settled into our hearts and minds. And for that, we give you thanks now in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, so sorry for that. I didn't quite see that one coming. All right, so we are looking now at what's called the Roman Republic. And I'll just give you this little kind of disclaimer right up front. Again, this is more than you ever wanted to know about the Roman Republic. Just work with me here. It is some interesting lessons. It does help us understand the Roman world in which, of course, the events of the New Testament take place. But this is a little bit of civics now. So I realize we're in Sunday school, and you may think this is kind of far afield for what Sunday school should be about, and I hope you'll just give me a little leash and see if I can hang myself, but let's take a look at this. We indicated last week the era of the Roman kings was, as we said, from 753, founded by Romulus, of course, and that whole legendary story, down to 509. The Roman Republic commences then officially in 509, although it's not very republican at the beginning. It takes a while to develop. It continues down, and most historians, I think, would say it ends distinctly in 49. 49 is when Julius Caesar famously crossed the Rubicon. And you know that that was the moment where he committed an illegal act, really challenging the authority of the Senate. A civil war was provoked by that act, and what happened at the other end of it was that really we have a great transformation then of Rome from this republic to more of what were at least the beginnings of a kind of imperial sort of existence. Caesar himself, of course, was assassinated in 44, but the change had happened. And so that's the time frame that we're looking at. We won't quite make it all the way through, but we'll get through most of this morning. The Etruscans, we said last week, had ruled Rome until 509. Then they revolted against this last king, Tarquin the Proud. We talked about that in some detail last week. Set up this new kind of government that was called the Res Publica. Res Publica, for you Latin scholars in the room, means public thing. They didn't know what else to call it, but it was going to be something other than what had been the case. Rule in Rome, as had been the case in most of the world, was a private thing. It was something reserved to the relative few. And now at this point, we have a transformation. Remember that democratic Athens was only still just barely on the drawing board. The golden age of republican democracy or of Athenian democracy was really the mid-400s. And so we're still in advance of that to some degree at this point in Rome. This is really the first time you have a true experiment, you might say, with not democracy as such, but with a sort of republican approach, meaning that governance is in some sense or other going to be in the hands of the many rather than in the hands of the few. And for lack of any better term to give it, they called it the Res Publica, and that gets us underway. In 509, we still have two distinct classes of people in Rome. We have the patricians on the one hand. The patricians were, especially in the early days of this era, still the head of the aristocratic families. They elected officials. They more or less ran the shop. The patricians controlled virtually everything. This was the habit the Romans were in. This included politics, religion, economics, the military. They maintained power through a fairly elaborate and complicated patronage system in which they maintained their authority and the continuity of their authority and so on. But with the changes that happened in 509, we do begin to see something else on the radar screen, and this is the rise of the influence of those who were called the plebeians. From the beginning, the plebs, the common people, had begun to challenge this exclusive control of governance in the hands of this oligarchy, this aristocratic gathering. And they continued to put on more and more pressure, but didn't get a lot of traction until the year 494, so about 15 years down the road. And what happened was that Rome was challenged by some of her surrounding neighbors. This was not uncommon, kind of wars and squabbles and so on. And Rome was actually being attacked. And as was the custom, the aristocrats said, okay, you plebs, let's go out and fight, you know, and kind of did the pep talk. And the plebs said, not so fast. You know, we are willing to fight your battles. We're willing to go out and defend Rome. But until we get some concessions from you guys, we're just going to hole up inside the sanctuary here and sit tight. And it put a huge amount of pressure on the aristocrats to make some kind of concession in order to mobilize the plebeians to go out and fight this battle. And so indeed, that was the first point where we really began to see the plebs now in Rome exercising some of their increasing political muscle. And so the patricians, knowing they had no ability to fight this battle on their own, made these concessions, and that was really the beginning. We have in 509, the Republic starts sort of technically, but in 494, we begin to actually see a huge shift, or at least a significant shift, in the way power was distributed in the Roman world. This gave rise to what was called the Plebeian Council. The Plebeian Council involved an assembly of people who were constituted strictly as those who represented the plebeian class. This is something like in England, the House of Nobles, the House of Commons. Something like that now is happening in the Roman world at about this time. They also, as an act of their own kind of deliberations, decided to elect a representative who would be called the tribune. And so at this point, we have the beginning in Roman history of a character known as the Tribune of the Plebs. And this individual had a fair amount of responsibility and had the responsibility in particular of representing plebeian interests at the table of those who were governing. And this guy was given a fair amount of horsepower. One of the most important was to protect the plebeian interests and so on. And the main weapon that was entrusted to him with great pressure from the plebs once again was the power of the veto. And so for the first time, you have someone representing the plebs who had a right of absolute veto, meaning if any law was proposed by the aristocratic class, which the plebs felt was contrary to their own interests, this tribune could veto it outright, and there was no overruling that veto. That's a very significant amount of power. You know, the president of the United States has a qualified veto. He can veto proposed legislation, but a supermajority, two-thirds of the House and the Senate, can override that. You all know that from high school civics, don't you? And in Rome, it wasn't that way. You see, this tribune had absolute veto rights. So that's a fair amount of clout that was now being shifted to the plebeian side. And this really does begin to balance out the, you might say, critical mass of governmental authority there in Rome as this begins to take shape. The other significant change that occurred in about this same time frame, 5th century BC, in Rome, is a change in the way in which the laws are treated. You know that Numa, that we looked at last week, was understood as the great lawgiver of Rome. And as the story goes, he got the law from the gods, And it was promulgated at that time, but oddly enough, it was never really written down in a public way. There was an understanding that there was this law, and there was a notion of lex rex, rule of law, and yet somehow or other, the law never really quite got out there where the public could actually see it. So it was still a bit of a well-kept secret, even though in principle, in philosophy, it was there. In practice, it was a little bit obscure. Well, in 450, so about 40 years later, the plebeians now put increasing pressure on to have those laws written publicly. And so as a result of that, they were in fact posted in the Forum there in Rome on 12 large tables in a public way so that now patrician judges couldn't make decisions and so on simply based on private opinion or on secret applications of the law. Now it was public. Now you really do have a notion of the rule of law as a practical matter. And this is another significant and really almost breathtaking change in the way in which the Roman world operated. Those laws were displayed in the Roman Forum. Some of you have actually visited this place. A little picture I pieced together from last time I was there. How many have been to the Roman Forum? We don't actually have the monument anymore where the tables were posted as such, but it was right in the middle of this. And so that was part of what made the Forum, of course, a center not only of government, but of commerce and so on, very important. Okay, what did this Republican government look like? Well, there were new offices and new institutions. We have the patricians and the plebeians working out in a kind of practical balance of negotiating power, certain policies. This is all happening in the 5th century, the 400s BC. All of these things are being put into place. There is the creation of certain new offices, and this becomes part of the distinctive character of Roman rule from this point on. There's generally three levels, or you might say virtually three branches of government in ancient Rome. They don't correspond exactly to our three branches of government, but there is a little bit of a correlation. But the three branches were, first of all, the Senate, and the Senate still was patrician. The Senate had 300 members. These were charged with the duty of advising elected officials, controlling public finances, handling foreign relations, and so on. They still had a huge amount of power. The next level were the popular assemblies. These were constituted by the plebs. They also had a fair amount of responsibility. These would elect, they would participate in public decisions and so on. And then the third level were called the magistrates. This would correspond roughly to our executive branch. These were the people who were charged with the duty of actually governing, but the distinctive character of the change here was now the magistrates would govern in the name of the Senate and the people, putting laws into practice in a kind of detached and even-handed way. So they didn't have a vested interest officially either in the patrician side or the plebeian side. They were simply the executives of the laws that were promulgated by virtue of the work of the Senate and the plebs. This is where this very famous symbol of Rome comes from. SPQR stands for the Senate and the People of Rome. And it dates back to about this time in Roman history when we begin to see a true balance between those who had once had all the power and those who once had none of the power, and now we begin to see this change. It's a remarkable thing, really, that you have this sort of thing happening at this moment. And in many ways, I think the greatness of Rome that came later was in some ways driven by the genius of what was worked out. It wasn't pretty. It was not a pretty picture. There was a whole lot of very rough kind of conduct going on during this time, but the long and short of it was that nevertheless we have this change, which is something of a unique development, I would say, in the history of political thought and so on. Initially, of course, the patricians had dominated all the state offices, but later the magistrate's offices now, the executive branch, but later it became open both to patricians and to plebs, and you began to have virtually an even representation of both. These magistrates, there are quite a few. I'm only going to mention the top three. I don't want to labor this too much, but these three I think are interesting and worth noting. The first of these magistrative branches or offices that were created at this time were called the consuls. And to this day, we'll hear of a consulate, and we'll hear that word used in various ways that dates back to this era of Roman history. When the last king was thrown out, the Roman people, instead of putting one person in the office to be a chief executive, put two people in, and they would, in a dual kind of sharing of power, rule. So you had two consuls from this point on who would rule, and each had veto power against the other. I really think that's pure genius. I kind of think in the United States we should have two presidents, and they should have veto. You know, I love gridlock. I tell you, the less Congress does, the better. And no, sorry, I don't mean to be political here, but anyway, this was a little bit of genius on the part of the Romans. They wanted to make sure nobody got too much power in his own corner, and so they put an equal person, and oddly enough, throughout Roman history, it tended to be the case that one of the consuls would come from the patrician class, and one would come from the plebeian class, so they would have conflicting interests. And you knew that if they ever actually agreed on anything, it would typically be in the interest of Rome, not in the interest of some faction within Rome, and that was part of, I think, what made this such a brilliant move on their part. So these were called consuls. They were only elected for 1 year. Talk about term limits. 1 year, two guys, and at the end of that year, they were forced to leave that office. Now, there came to be exceptions later, but the exceptions were really illegal and were the result of kind of a political pressure and sometimes military pressure. But the official rule was something like this, and for many years, that's about the way it worked. The next level down from the consuls were the censors. These would be the ones who were connected to the census taking. Last week we talked about the king, Tullius Hostilius, who in fact implemented this notion of taking a census. It was one of the most important design changes in Roman history, and now it begins to take its full shape. Because those who took the census not only were noticing the numbers of people, but they were noticing how many people were living in what parts of town, what were the social strata from which they came, and there was a significant amount of the distribution of rights and privileges and also responsibilities that flowed out of this, and this all came as part of the responsibility of the censors. So they were quite important. They filled vacancies in the Senate as well. The praetors were the next one down. You've heard of the Praetorian Guard. Well, this goes back to these characters. They would act as judges. They would temporarily fill the role of a consul if the consul happened to be away at war, something like that. And these characters would sometimes, once they'd served as a praetor, get a military command. Julius Caesar had been working his way up the ranks of these offices in Rome, and when he was the praetor, he was assigned the governorship he was assigned the governorship of a place called Gaul. And you know from about 60 to 50, the Gallic Wars were when Julius Caesar really made a name for himself, and he was able to conquer all of that region, and it was in 49, right after that was over, that we have this change in Roman history. So he had worked his way up through the ranks, basically through the offices mentioned here. This government worked quite well. There was a great deal of elaborate checks and balances. There was the strong conviction that no one person and no one branch of government should get too much power. James Madison, when he wrote Federalist 10, was clearly indebted to this Republican experiment that went back to Roman history. He doesn't mention it by name, but certainly the thought in his mind and the whole notion of what you could call faction management that he talks about there in that particular brilliant document that he wrote, the father of our Constitution, you know, really does show that he was deeply educated by what the Romans had done. He has other sources as well, but he certainly owed quite a bit to them, and we see part of the reason why. All right, that's all I'm going to do about Republican government in Rome. Now I want to shift more to the history of how Rome began to expand and grow, and it's going to take us down about to the time of the Maccabean Revolt, which is where we'll leave off today. So, in 509, we have the founding of the Republic, as we were saying. Rome at this point controls about 800 square miles, which isn't a whole lot of real estate. The city itself and a narrow swath that went from the city down the Tiber River to the city of Ostia, that was we mentioned last week, all of that constituted Rome in 509. So it's not an empire, it's not all that big really. There were certainly other provinces and cities and so on that controlled more than Rome did. Rome, at this point, no one would have guessed that they would become the dominant power in the world. You just never would have guessed it at this time, but nevertheless, that's about where we were. When the Roman Republic was created in 509, she was facing significant threats. Some of those threats were external. She was surrounded by powerful enemies that didn't like her very much, and so there was constantly a kind of military footing in Rome in which they were always having to watch their backside with respect to neighbors, and this was pretty typical of much of the ancient world at that time. But there was also these internal conflicts. The tension between the ruling class, the aristocrats, and the plebeian class was a time of tumultuous instability. This didn't happen in a pretty way. There were some rough roads along the way, but this first 100 years or so was when some of these details were being worked out. During that time, there wasn't much growth. Rome was developing herself internally, but not growing much externally. That changed slightly in the year 406. The main city that was the threat to Rome was a city called Veii, V-E-I-I. It was an Etruscan city, and there was a constant feud going on between Rome and Veii. And it finally erupted in full-blown war in the year 406. So now we're down about 100 years from the beginning of the Roman Republic, and now Rome is in a significant conflict with what appeared to be a more powerful adversary. And that what happened was Rome actually put this city under siege for about 10 years. And after the 10 years, the city of Veii fell. And as a result of that, Rome expanded somewhat dramatically, incorporating now not only her own territories, but those that had belonged to Veii. She probably would have expanded even more, except that there was a swift and brutal attack that came from the Gallic tribes to the north, and a famous chieftain whose name was Brennus. Good-looking guy. And he was brilliant. He was sort of like an early version of Hannibal. He was really very much a military genius, and he brought these Gallic tribes down, and they just were pillaging and marauding through the countryside of Italy until finally they wound up at Rome's doorstep. And Rome was really put on the ropes by this guy and held at bay for some time. They finally actually didn't defeat him, but they just negotiated a truce with him, gave him a whole bunch of stuff, you know, gold and silver and a bunch of other things, and made him go away, and he did. But that did kind of slow them down a little bit, so that was a bump in the road. But then over the next 60 years or so, you do begin to see Rome, now that her Etruscan adversary is set aside, begins to expand somewhat more dramatically. So the red section of this map that you're looking at there represents where Rome was in about the year 338. So again, it's not a great empire, but you can see that there is now a significant amount of growth that's taking place. By 290, Rome is wrapping up what are called the Samnite Wars. The Samnites were neighboring a cluster of cities, really, that represented a fair amount of the middle part of Italy. And after a series of battles, they were able to expand to this point. So now we're at 290, beginning of the 3rd century. And you begin to see now a trajectory. This republican government, oddly enough, is actually quite effective in dealing with adversaries. And one of the distinctive features of Rome, which goes clear back to those kings, was they really didn't try to beat the tar out of their enemies. They really did try to incorporate them and make them part of the Roman world. I think this is the beginnings of that vision from Daniel of iron mixed with clay. Rome was always cobbled together by various people who had various, you know, opinions about things and values and so on. But if they could sort of find their way into the big tent of Rome, they would be okay. And that was really the philosophy that Rome followed. And in some ways, that was a rather distinct feature of her, and it accounted for at least some of the growth that we begin to see. All right, so we're at 280 now, and this brings us to the next significant moment in Roman growth, which is called the Pyrrhic Wars. This guy is Pyrrhus. Pyrrhus was a Greek king. He was ruling in a part of Greece, or Macedon really, called Epeirus. And remember now, we're at the year 280. Alexander the Great is dead. He died in 323. But if you can imagine in your mind's eye, Greece and all points east, have come under Greek control. We looked at all of this last year in some detail. But Alexander takes the Greek Empire to the world. He dies too soon. His empire is divided up among Greek generals who had served under him, Ptolemy, Cassander, Antigonus, Antiochus, Seleucus, and so on. You know all those names we looked at. But that's all points east. Pyrrhus styled himself as another Alexander the Great. He thought history, he thought 2,000 years later we'd be sitting in Sunday school talking about Pyrrhus the Great. That was his vision. But he wanted to take the Greek world west. And so he'd already been thinking about this. And what happened in 280 approximately was that a little Greek city, remember Greece, you may recall from last week, Greece controlled the southern part of Italy, the island of Sicily, and had a pretty robust presence there, a trade presence and so on, and were a fairly dominant force. There was a town in the so-called boot there of Italy called Taras. It was a Greek city, and the people living there were getting nervous about Rome because they'd seen the Romans continuing to pressure them, and they saw Roman ships sailing out there in the bay, and they began to think, you know, I think we're the next target for these guys. And so they email Pyrrhus, and they say, hey man, you know all of those grand visions you've got for expanding in the West and becoming the next Alexander? Well, here's your prime opportunity, because the Romans are putting pressure on us, and we'd love it if you'd come over and rescue us. And Pyrrhus thought, cool. And so he loaded up about 30,000 soldiers and 17 elephants and sailed across the Adriatic there and landed, and it was quite a sight, I guess, at least as far as it's described. You know, all of these guys just looking wonderfully powerful as military sorts, and the elephants, the ancient version of an army tank, you know, sort of thing. They all showed up, and they were going to teach those Romans a lesson. And so for about 8 years, we have a period called the Pyrrhic Wars. Some of you have heard the expression Pyrrhic victory, haven't you? You know that expression? There's got to be a hand in there. Never heard? Okay. Thank you. Philip, can you say off the top of your head, what is a Pyrrhic victory?
It's a victory that's essentially a loss.
Right.
You win in title, but in winning, you're basically gutted.
Perfect answer. Give that man a hand. I mean, that is good stuff. And that's exactly what happened. Pyrrhus came. He won every engagement with the Romans. Every time, he won. And he was reputed to have said more than once, I can't afford to beat these guys one more time, you know. Because even though he would win, it would be at such losses that it was virtually, as a practical matter, a loss, even though technically he walked away the winner. The only battle that he finally didn't win was the last one, when he was sent sailing home with only a fraction of his original force. None of the elephants survived, you know, all of it was over. It took about 8 years. Pyrrhus himself died in a street fight about 4 years later in the Greek city of Argos, and that was it, so that's why most of us have never heard much about Pyrrhus. But anyway, what happened as a result of that was that Rome was now able to absorb and occupy the southern part of Italy. So now we have Rome essentially, in the year 272, dominating all of the Italian peninsula. And this brings us now to the next big conflict in the middle of the 3rd century called the First Punic War. You've all heard of the Punic Wars. There were actually three, but two in particular are important. The first of these, I won't go into the details, we don't need it, but just be aware that with Greece now becoming of diminishing importance, kind of being squeezed out, it only left two players. It left Rome in the north and, of course, Carthage in the south. And we talked about last week the three great cities that were originally there, Rome, Syracuse, and Carthage. Well, Syracuse is now being squeezed, the Greek city, and the whole Greek population is feeling the pressure. And now it's leaving these two. And a little triggering event or set of events brought Rome and Carthage into a conflict with each other at this point. And this is called the First Punic War. The long and short of it was that by the time it was over, without going into the details, Rome had absorbed the two major islands that had been under Carthaginian control, Sardinia and Corsica, which are off to the west there, those beautiful islands there in the Mediterranean. And so the First Punic War, again, was won by Rome and represented another great expansion. In the interregnum here between the First and Second Punic Wars, we have what are called the Illyrian Wars. There was a queen in Illyria, which is over in Macedon, who had been giving Rome some grief, and they had some battles with her. And that becomes the first toehold of the Romans in Macedon. So now we see them kind of moving west, Corsica, Sardinia, moving east, Illyria. The Carthaginians are worried. They bring a fair number of people over to the Iberian Peninsula. It's not on this map, but it would be off to the left. That would be Spain, and they have now a presence there. And so during these years, young Hannibal, who's been taught by his father to hate the Romans with a passion and imbibes that attitude on steroids, then launches in 219 the Second Punic War. And of course, the most famous character of this was Hannibal, who was basically leading a brilliant raiding party up and down the Italian peninsula for about 20 years. He was never defeated. Every time he met the Romans, you know, heads on in the conflict, he always won. He was a brilliant tactician, but he just couldn't quite get the horsepower. He was hoping that as a result of his successes against the Roman army, the population generally of Italy would rally to him and revolt against the Romans. And so he thought he was coming as a liberating savior. But as it turns out, the people in Italy didn't dislike the Romans all that much. And so Hannibal, thinking that he was going to be the centerpiece of this kind of public support, found himself very lonely. And so even though he was brilliant, a genius for sure, one of the greatest of all history, he was never able to rally enough popular support for his efforts to be very successful. Eventually, he was defeated at the Battle of Zama, Z-A-M-A, in 202, just outside of Carthage. He went off and became a helper to Antiochus the Great later on. But anyway, as a result of the Second Punic War, now Rome is controlling, you can see, a huge amount of the center of the Mediterranean world, including now Sicily. So, where does that leave us? We're at the year 200. We've seen rather astonishing growth, and at this point, this is what the ancient Near East looks like. That purple section right in the middle of your map is the Seleucid Empire. If you were in this class last year, we talked about the run-up to the Seleucid Empire, and I'm not going to go back over that, but just take it on faith at this point if you weren't here, that Seleucid, kind of the ruler, the Greek ruler of Syria, had extended his holdings throughout a huge amount of the ancient Near East, and that was the section that he controlled. The middle section, you probably can't see it well, but I'll show it better in a moment, of Macedon, the Greek peninsula, is ruled by a guy named Philip V. And he was quite a brilliant king and quite a brilliant military tactician, but he simply didn't have the horsepower to resist the greater forces that were afoot in the world at that time. And Rome controlled everything off to the west. So you've got the ancient world in the year 200 looking kind of like this. The Roman Republic is in the west, the Italian peninsula, Carthage, Sicily, and even over into Spain, all of that is under Roman control. The middle section is under Macedonian control and this king named Philip V. The eastern section is under Antiochus III. So that's the lay of the land in the year 200. What happens is that Philip picks a fight with Rome. Not a smart move, but then he hadn't read all the history books that would be written 1,000 years later and didn't know that, you know, he was doomed to failure in this effort. So he decides that he's going to assist Hannibal, and he does get involved with Hannibal in earlier years, and as a result of that gets himself crosswise with the Romans, and eventually the two come to blows. And as a result of that, in the year 197, Rome defeated Philip in what was called the Second Macedonian War. And this war was really the point where we find Rome now dramatically expands her area of influence in an easterly direction. So now, not only is the Roman Republic dominating Italy, but as of the year 197, is pretty much dominating Greece. This is a famous incident, and it's a kind of a fun story to tell, but time doesn't permit. So the Romans, again, kind of viewed themselves as liberators, and the Greeks in some ways saw it the same way. They didn't like the Macedonians all that much, the Greeks in the south, and so it was kind of complicated, but the bottom line was Rome expanded into that region. Antiochus III, Epiphanes. Now, if you were here last year, you recall that he, Antiochus the Great, as he was called, the Third, had sent his daughter Cleopatra to marry Ptolemy VI, the young king in Egypt. For how many of you does that ring a bell? It was about 5 months ago. Thank you. Oh, you've done wonders for me. You know, it's so important for me to know that you know who Antiochus III was. I mean, I lay awake nights worrying about whether you... Antiochus III sent his daughter. This is the first Cleopatra. There were seven of them. This is the first one. He sends her with specific instructions. Cleo, honey, I want you to go down and marry that Ptolemy VI, who's about 3 years younger than you. He was about 14, she was 17, and I want you to sell him on what a great guy your dad is, so that he will sort of steer himself into the fold of Syrian control. Cleopatra goes to Egypt, marries this younger man, 14, 15 years old, but she also is a very smart lady who realizes that probably a smarter bet is Rome, as opposed to her dad, Antiochus III. And so instead of doing her dad's bidding, she in fact says, you know, I think we should be making friends with Rome, because look at how they're kind of approaching and so on. And that's what happens. Antiochus is very upset about that and decides he'll go teach those Romans a lesson. And so he launches, in about the year 195, a series of conflicts with Rome in Macedon. He wants to retake Macedon, drive out the Romans, push them back into the west, and then he'll come back and say neener neener to his daughter and make her feel bad, and everything will have a happy ending. Well, the actual effect of this conflict was that he lost big time, and that Rome once again was able to expand its control, defeating Antiochus. And this resulted in what was called the Peace of Apamea, which took place in 188. Antiochus himself died the following year, and the effect was to push the Roman control even further to the east. And so now we have Rome not only dominating, of course, Italy and Greece, but now you'll see most of Turkey is within her fold, and Rome is now definitely putting pressure on the region that we would call, you know, Palestine, and even starting to put pressure toward Mesopotamia. So this is just the growth. And oddly enough, in each case, it was somebody picking a fight with the Romans that resulted in these growth spurts. I think a fair assessment says the Romans never went out and really picked a fight. Now, they did do some saber rattling, but in some ways, they were always fighting a defensive war that they won. And as a result, they grew in the ways that we see described here. In 168, Rome actually shows up in Egypt, and you may recall that's the famous incident between the Roman senator who was there and Antiochus IV, who was this madman who was responsible in some ways for the outbreak of the Maccabean Revolt. He was the one that drew the line in the sand around Antiochus IV, if you recall that story from last year. And that's where I want to leave off our discussion this morning. So we're right now just at the beginning of the Maccabean Revolt, and I hope this has helped us see how Rome was now really in the backyard of the people of God by about this time. And what we want to do next week is pick up and really carry the story forward through the Civil War and into the New Testament era. We will get to Augustus Caesar next week, and of course Jesus himself was born under the rule of that character, so that's our plan from there. All right, Sunday school lesson for the morning. I was given a bit of a bad time by unnamed persons because I didn't really have a good Sunday school lesson last week, and I've given myself precious little time for it this morning, but hopefully this will be helpful. Let's come back to Luke chapter 7 and think about this centurion. This story would be taking place in about the year 29 AD, and there's still a pretty distinct memory in the Roman psyche of these days of the Roman culture, the Roman Republic. In other words, these Caesars were not trying to change the grand history of Rome and just abandon it or leave it behind. And many of these, especially military types, it was still there. And I think we see at least traces of it here. So I have four lessons that I'd like for us to learn from this centurion. And they, surprisingly enough, represent the four letters of the word Rome. Just amazing how it worked out. So let's see what those lessons are. The first lesson is respect. I want you to notice this centurion. Notice the respect that we find in him for his slave. He very much cared for his slave and wanted him to recover. The respect he had for Israel. He built their synagogue. The respect he had for Jesus. Now, I think we can safely say that the respect that is conspicuous in this man's life was at least to some substantial measure the result of God's grace at work in his heart. But it was still reflective of the psyche of the Romans. They did have an idea of honor. They had an idea of respect. They didn't always express it as well as we might have hoped. But nevertheless, they had a pretty well-defined notion of what it meant to honor someone, those who were worthy of honor, those who were worthy of respect. And so we're not too surprised to see these characteristics showing up in this man. I'm especially interested in how the Jewish people, who are intermediaries between the centurion and Jesus, say he's worthy of having you do this for him. He's worthy, in other words, of your respect. And the reason they give is because he himself has been so respectful. And so my first Sunday school lesson, which I hope is pretty obvious, is that the people we meet in life are worthy of our respect, aren't they? Sometimes we meet people that are respectable. Sometimes we meet people that are not so respectable. But insofar as we meet anybody in any human situation, regardless of what they've done, such people were created as God's handiwork, and they are ones who are proper recipients of his message of good news in Christ. And that in itself should give us warrant to, by God's grace, respect even those who are not very respectable in the name and the work of Christ. And I think we see certainly in this man a good example of that. The O here is for obedience. Notice this remarkable thing that he says, beginning down in verse 6, Lord, don't trouble yourself. I'm not worthy for you to come. I didn't presume to come to you. He makes this statement, for I am also a man under authority with soldiers under me. And I say to one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes. And to my slave, do this, and the slave does it. The man understood authority. He understood obedience. He understood what it meant to be in authority and have people under him. He also understood what it meant to be under authority and respond to people over him. He had a grasp of that. The Romans had a deep sense of authority. They knew about checks and balances. They knew that nobody should have absolute power, that in some ways everybody should be under somebody's authority. At least the limitations of jurisdiction should apply to all of us, because in a sense none of us can be trusted with absolute power. The Romans had learned that, and they'd attempted to implement that principle. And so again, even though we grant to this centurion some kind of supernatural insight with respect to the character of Christ, he's also reflecting what is genuinely a Roman principle of the idea of authority. The Apostle Paul tells us in Romans chapter 13, there is no authority except from God. And as we go through life and deal with authority, we can always say to ourselves, this authority, wherever it may be, whatever relationship it may be that's giving expression to it, could not even exist but for God. Authority can be abused, but the abuse of authority is not the negation of it. It just means the person abusing it is going to have to give an account of the way in which they abused the power that was given to them. But the fact that there is authority in this world is, again, I think, beautifully illustrated by our centurion friend. The third, the M, is for model. I love this line. This is down in verse 9. When Jesus heard this, he was amazed, and turning to the crowd that followed him, he said, "I tell you the truth, not even in Israel have I found such faith." Jesus sometimes displays amazement. I think from a theological point of view, we would say the amazement is more tutorial. In other words, sometimes when you're dealing with your three-year-old grandchild, you might look into something and go, "Wow!" Well, you're not expressing your amazement. You're doing it for the experience of the child, aren't you? You're showing amazement so the child can share somehow in what is apparently happening. And I think Jesus would do something like that occasionally as he was shepherding his people. Here's a centurion who says something remarkably, potently, powerfully true, and Jesus goes, "Wow!" because he wants his followers to get it. This is amazing. This is worthy of your respect. This man is modeling faith in a way that I haven't found it modeled even among the people of God. And in precisely what respect is he modeling it? In his respect, in his obedience, all of these things taken together, his faith, his understanding of authority, all of this displays something that Jesus wants to hold up for us. The thing we should gather from this, of course, is that we are modeling for somebody the life of faith. Sometimes we know it, sometimes we don't. Sometimes we know who's watching, sometimes we don't. I can't tell you how many times, well, I'm not even going to take time to tell that. We're running out of time here, so just scratch that from the record. But you know we are all being watched as we drive, as we look at stuff in the store, as we just conduct our, somebody's watching you, and sometimes you don't know it, do you? We are all modeling it. The final one, the E, is for effect. A life lived in obedience to the principles that are certainly reflected in this centurion and reflective of the ethic of the New Testament has an effect in the real world. This man's slave was healed. Your life can bring healing in its wake as you walk in faithful conformity to that which Christ has set before you as your call. This is not just mysticism. It's not just poetry. Our lives have an effect, and that effect is very much a part of what we are called to do as we build the kingdom and participate in a life of faithful obedience to Christ. I think we learn all of these things, at least to some degree, from this Roman centurion. And I think he learned it, at least to some limited degree, from his great Roman tradition, although I want to say God's grace was very much at work in his life.